Welcome to It Just So Happens. I am Richard Pulsford, stand-up comedian and rather unprofessional historian. In this show, recorded for the It Just So Happened podcast, we will explore some of the historical people associated with and events which happened on this very day in history, which is the 10th of August. That's before we delve into some of the history of the place where today's show is taking place. So where are we? It's the city which Time Out magazine last year rated the best in the world. Yes, it's Edinburgh. We're performing today as part of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, the largest annual international arts festival in the world. And our venue this morning is the Hill Street Theatre, situated in Edinburgh's New Town. This historic A-listed building dates back to the 1820s. In 1893, it was purchased by the Masonic Lodge of Edinburgh's Mary's Chapel No. 1, so called because the lodge first met within the old chapel of St Mary's and Nidre's Wynd in Edinburgh. It's designated No. 1 on the roll of lodges of the Grand Lodge of Scotland, as it possesses the oldest existing minute of any Masonic lodge still operating, dating back to 1599, and the first historical reference of a Freemason being initiated as a member in 1634. Making this likely to be the oldest Masonic lodge not only in Scotland, but the world. The building has also been used as a fringe venue for the past 37 years, which makes it the oldest fringe venue constantly in operation. Fittingly, we have an audience with us today, as the fringe welcomes audiences of up to 400,000 people each year. So we welcome about 100,000 to this show. So what's drawn in such huge numbers? Well, let me introduce today's panel. Please welcome Stella Graham, Dave Chawner, and Paul Connolly. So Stella Graham, your stand-up comedian, who's entertained audiences all around the world, from the Comedy Store in LA to the Adelaide Fringe, Perth Fringe, and New Zealand Comedy Festival. And I believe you're also the funniest half Sri Lankan lass from Coventry.
I will die on that hill. I'll find another.
Excellent. Welcome to the show. And Dave Chawner is a number one best-selling author and award-winning comedian. I believe you've appeared on BBC Breakfast, Good Morning Britain, and The Rain.
That would be more compelling if you weren't reading that. Like, that was the way that you went, I think you've done that. But yeah, it's like that. It's
very nice.
Lovely. And Paul Connolly is an Edinburgh-based actor and improviser, most notable for his work in TVC Improv and Spontaneous Players, Spontaneous Potter. When not thrilling crowds with wondrous performances as a wizard or a phoenix, Paul can often be found trying to prove that double denim is cool. And telling anecdotes about New York.
New York, yes. I go over quite frequently. I've performed in New York, done training there, and I often will, as we all do, when you're telling a little anecdote and you want to share the conversation, I'll start with this one time in New York. Has become a running gag now in the improv community in Edinburgh, that as soon as I start running these anecdotes, you go, wait, you've been to New York? This is the first we're hearing this.
So, welcome to the panel. So, Stella, straight over to you. Thank you for your On This Day piece.
All right. So, on this day, Jim Morrison, lead singer of The Doors. You look fairly young over there. Do you know The Doors? No? Excellent. One for you to check out on TikTok later. Before I continue with this tale, may I ask how old are you? 15. Okay. That was going to be very key into how I might edit this tale.
I thought you were asking, did you want some sort of register? That was the way that you said that. It was quite nerve-wracking.
No. Well, not yet, you know. The fringe is coming. Let's see. I'll do anything for PR. Listen. So, on this day, The Doors lead singer Jim Morrison went on trial in Florida, charged with various crimes after allegedly exposing himself during a Miami concert in 1969. He was later found guilty. Now, it's the details of this story that particularly hooked me in. Do you have any Americans in? Do you know this story?
I love somewhat.
Somewhat. Were you at the concert?
Yeah.
Oh, you look too young. You look too young. All right, that's all right. I'll paint the picture. So, the charges resulted from Morrison and The Doors' performance at Coconut Grove's Old Dinnerkey Auditorium the year before. That's why I'm reading this. There's too many details. He was eventually found guilty of just two charges. Indecent exposure and open profanity, and was sentenced to 6 months in jail and a $500 fine. And here's why I like this story. The crux of the case hinged on whether or not Morrison actually revealed his genitalia to the 10,000 people in attendance that night. Whether he did or not was a sticking point, I bet it was, between the defence and the prosecution at the time. And the group's guitarist, Robbie Krieger, has been quick to point out there are no pictures at all to validate the claim, despite the fact that nearly 500 photos were entered into the record as evidence during the trial. 10,000 people are at a concert. He's on stage. Surely, surely, someone would have got a picture. But this is back in 1969, people that had camera phones and stuff like that. According to the show promoter, there was no doubt whether Morrison did it. He was obscene. There was no question about it. He went on to describe the sequence of events, beginning with Morrison asking the crowd, "Do you want to see my cockerel?" At which point, Collier jumped on stage, grabbed the microphone away, while Morrison grabbed his crotch and pretended to scratch his cockerel behind him. The trial lasted 40 days, and Morrison was allowed to remain free and headed back to California to finish working on the rest of the Doors album, L.A. Woolley. From there, he booked a flight to Paris, where he lived until his death, sadly, in 1971, and in 2010, Morrison was granted a unanimous pardon by the Florida State Clemency Board for his crime, though his widow, Patricia Cornelia Morrison, was actually peeved by the gesture and said, "I have a real problem with the semantics of that pardon." The pardon says that he went through all this suffering, but sad in the end, isn't it? One thing that made me laugh is that he said he was on trial for lewd and lascivious behaviour. I didn't know how to say that word. So
yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
I literally went on and
I thought it was licentious.
Lascivious.
I had to go on to Google to get the pronunciation.
Lascivious.
So there you go. That is the term Jim Morrison. I'll understand.
Thank you, Stella. So I've got a couple of segue pieces between the panels. So this is my first one. I've got questions to the panelists here. So in what year did the Louvre Museum in Paris officially open, do you think?
Not yet. 1997.
Really? I just said,
bet you it was open in 1997. I'll bet you anything. You were able to go inside there and see things
very
in 1997.
Good. See, you can tell he's an improviser.
Yeah. Officially opening, yes.
I said 1902.
I'm saying 30.
I was going to go for something in the 70s, but I'm saying 17.
In 19 or something.
Yeah.
No. 1472.
Not the 70s in Roman times, of that. So it actually opened on 10th of August, this day, in 1793.
Wow.
With an exhibition of 537 paintings. Where did the majority of the works come from when it first opened?
I mean, as I was so close on my previous guess, I think I'm going to nail this. I'm going to say France.
Yes.
I think that's the trap. You're doing a QI. I bet you... Did you say 1792?
1792.
I'd say Holland.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Okay, yeah. Going around to that.
Holland or Italy?
Ireland.
Well...
Europe.
So it was... what the answer I was looking for was it was royal and confiscated church property. Uh-huh. So from around Paris. It's the world's biggest and most visited museum. If you were to spend just 30 seconds on each piece of art in the Louvre, it would still take you 100 days to get through them all. And why you do it that way? The museum holds an estimated 380,000 pieces of art, of which only about 10% are on public display. What is the museum's most visited painting?
Sure,
thank you. Mona Lisa.
Yeah. It's been on permanent display there since 1797.
Yeah.
When was it painted? Who was the painting subject?
Oh, and I used to know this.
See, I don't know the year, but I'm great. Isn't it that nobody really quite knows? There's like a lot of theories as to who the person is, but nobody's quite sure exactly who it is.
Yeah, there's no exact
text. If you ever get bored, YouTube this, because there's some amazing conspiracy theories. But like, it was like the ancient Aztecs that did it, and it was... there's meanings behind, like, how there's a dark matter portal somewhere in Croydon. So they're madness.
You're going to say you never went to the moon?
Yeah. The Mona Lisa. Because there's something to do with the
perspective of, like, normally, like, paintings are done in a third, and it's actually, it's slightly, the actual perspective is slightly off kilter, and it's actually, like, technically, it's not that much of a good painting.
But if you may say so yourself.
I could have knocked one out in half the time, mate.
Was it meant to be like a self-portrait?
I've not heard that one.
It's a rumour I'm spreading with giants.
As conspiracy theories go, I quite like that one.
Yeah.
So it was believed to have been painted between about 1503 and 1506, but Leonardo may well have been continuing to work on it until as late as 1517, so it kind of took quite a long time, potentially. The painting has been definitively identified to depict Italian noblewoman Lisa Gherardini, of course, we all know.
That was the alter ego of Leonardo.
Yes, that was his like Jekyll and Hyde type thing.
Yeah, was this what he liked to do?
It was acquired by King Francis I of France, so it's now the property of the French Republic. How big do you think the painting is?
That's not as big as
postage stamp.
That doesn't go very well on the podcast.
I love the fact that everybody's joined in with me.
It's actually about that much.
It's like an A3 poster size.
It's not very big, so
I find that men always overemphasize size, so I go stellar on this one.
Well, I'm going to boast that it's 77 by 53 centimeters, or 30 by 21 inches, so it's not very big. The 1911 theft of the Mona Lisa and its subsequent return was reported worldwide, and that led to a massive increase in public recognition of the painting. During the 20th century, it was an object of mass reproduction, merchandising, lampooning and speculation, and was claimed to have been reproduced in 300 paintings and 2,000 advertisements. Surprised it was only as blip as that to come.
Yeah.
And that's the end of my segue, so over to you now for your own
segue. Sticking with Paris, France, my favourite of the Parises, on this day in 1792, a large-scale insurrection of the French monarchy occurred. So this is a defining event in the French Revolution. So as soon as the insurrection... So insurrection was like basically they like stormed the Paris, where I think they stormed the palace where the king was. And the assembly announced the suspension of the king. The king was placed under strong guard. It was like that film, what's the one? Les Miserables. It was like that, but like live. And the assembly decided to dissolve the assembly and keep the power in their own hands. Interesting thing about this, right, is what I find really interesting. This led to France becoming a republic. And Republic, it was obviously written by Plato, and I'm doing a show all about the history of Western philosophy. So I kind of thought I could just wank on about that for a bit and then hopefully get into my show. But one of the things that I think is really interesting is France has got this Republic now, so they kind of dissolved and it was Plato that wrote the Republic. But something we do forget about Plato's Republic is he actually thought that democracy was a bad thing. And that we shouldn't have democracy. And part of the French Revolution is it led to democracy. And I'm not saying I think that we should have a dictatorship. Unless I'm the dictator. Yeah. But I just think that everyone says democracy is really good, but like some people are like fucking idiots. And I don't think that everyone should have the vote. Like, I genuinely think you should be able to lose your vote. Like, if ever you've owned a live, laugh, love sign, you shouldn't be allowed to vote, right? Ever you've been on Guru Doodoo's silent disco tour at the Edinburgh Fringe, no vote for you, and you should be sterilised, right? That's, I feel very passionate about that. Anyone that starts too many sentences with, not many people realise this, no vote for you. I genuinely think that democracy is a brilliant idea, but it still has flaws. But in 1792, on this day, was the start of kind of proper democracy and the Republic coming to France.
So, can I ask, what was Plato in favour of them?
Plato's, so it was really interesting. He kind of nicked an idea from Socrates and he said there should be three groups of people. So you've got the guardians, the rulers and the producers. So the guardians were responsible for ruling the city. The rulers were responsible for guarding the city,
and the producers of a 1967
album.
Yeah, but he basically broke, and again, I think it hasn't aged well, because he wasn't like very forward thinking, like saying that like there wasn't a lot of. Actually, I think he might have been. I can't remember. Plato Socrates was in favour of women holding powerful positions. But he basically said that everyone should have their own role within society. So essentially, farmers farm. That's their job, and they're experts at it. Plato was really interested in the idea of this expert, which is, again, problem with democracy, of the vote of an expert. So, I mean, I joke about this, but I think it's madness that someone with a professorship in politics and economics has exactly the same say in who runs the country that I do. Like, I know nothing. Like, I genuinely, this is really bad, I was telling someone this the other day, I voted for Jeremy Corbyn in the last election because someone pointed out he looks a little bit like Obi-Wan Kenobi, and I thought that would be really funny to get, and like, I have the same, like, that's why I voted for him, so I think that's really bad. But Plato thought that you should have different areas of expertise, and instead of trying for everyone to have a say about everything, people should have their own little tranches.
Interesting. But let's face it, Plato wasn't as good a footballer as Socrates.
Banter.
But the banter is something to do.
I just want
to
do this.
Oh, yes.
But so, French Revolution was mean, man. Like, not a lot of people realise that. It was genuinely, like, I think on this day, I was reading, yesterday, 10,000 people died.
Fine.
It's just nice and uplifting, isn't it? Thursday morning.
Well, let's move on to a segue from that. questions to the panel. Which US president was born on this day in 1874?
Donald Trump.
I was going to say Joe Biden. It's the same.
Yes, pretty much.
What was the year again?
1874.
What one of the fun ones? Jimmy Carter.
No, you've got to go and watch with that.
That's all I know. I'm sorry, but that's the only president.
Think of household appliances.
Hoover.
Yay!
Oh, I was going to say toaster.
Yeah, but Hoover. Yeah, so from the Louvre to the Hoover is what I'm thinking. You're laughing far too much at that.
That's great. That's so good.
Yeah, well, I have a pun, man. So, Hoover won the 1928 US presidential election. As of the 2020 election, I can't quite even still get the headphones. So, as of the 2020 election, the 1928 election was the last time that the party of the incumbent president won without their nominee being the incumbent president or the incumbent vice president.
What's incumbent?
So the one who's already in power.
The one who's in power.
Right.
That makes sense to you, Paul.
Yeah, because... I'm joking. I think it's Calvin Coolidge.
Have you been to New York? Is that where you know this?
But it was... Because the guy who was the president before Hoover had basically had this, like, massive... What we would now understand as, like, a mental breakdown. Like, he lost his kid, and he just became reclusive, and he just closed himself off. Well, I think it was Calvin Coolidge. I may have that wrong. But he basically just went, do you know what? I'm kind of done with politics and all this stuff. So he was actually... I mean, he was a Republican president. He was fine. It was the Gilded Age, you know, started in the 1920s, so economically not fantastic for most people. But he just kind of went, I can't do this anymore. So that's why Hoover runs. And then there's a little thing that happens in 1929, which I won't... Spoiler, just in case, your next thing's going from that.
So what happened during the first year in office, which meant him quickly losing popularity?
It's the crash of Wall Street. The Great Depression starts.
Yeah.
And exactly.
Why is it called Great? Like, it can't have been that good.
Well, it's like the Great Wars.
I think it's in the words of the chant from The Simpsons, large and immense.
Nice. was that Hoover's fault?
No, not at all. But Hoover staunchly opposed any intervention from the federal government in the US economy, saying economic depression cannot be cured by legislative action or executive pronouncements.
What's that mean? Just talking normal language.
The
hands off thing. A bit like this trust saying, we'll just leave the markets to do their thing.
did, basically.
Yes, it's a form of politics that says that in private industry will solve all your problems, that government's its only role is in law enforcement, basically, and international policy. The rest of the time, you leave it to private entities. And this, the what we've had over the past 40-odd years with Thatcherism and Reaganomics has had that similar philosophy. And so in the 20s, it was at its real apex, and there was a lot of speculation, so people guessing that things are going to make a lot of money, putting a lot of money into things that don't make money. So then when everybody goes, actually, is any of this making money? Oh, no, it's not. Let's get all this money out. Suddenly,
so are you telling me back then they didn't think of Eat Out to Help Out? Yeah. A government scheme just to really help things along.
Well, they had prohibition as well in the 1920s, so they didn't even have alcohol.
Wow.
They didn't even have the taxes from alcohol.
Wasn't prohibition just like essentially one big happy hour? Like everyone drank?
Well, yeah, it turns out that if you say to people that you can't do something, they'll find a way to still do it.
Yeah. So,
funny enough, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where does Hoover rank in the critical assessment of presidents through the ages? Is it busy? Good one and bad one.
What was Hoover's first name?
Herbert.
Oh, that was Henry, yeah.
Almost.
How does he rank?
Yeah.
But he's just seen as like a very ineffective, right? In that, because you've got the Hoover Dam that gets set up for him, but he's just.
Did he do that?
Well, I don't think he did it himself. I think he hired some people to do it for him.
We are officially the dumbest panelists ever. I thought Hoover's first name was JFK.
There is a
trigger
Hoover,
that was
the FBI.
He was a
trader,
yeah.
Any relation?
They actually don't know, does he?
No.
No, that's good. We're definitive.
Americans are just like these crazy, you know, nothing.
Thank you.
That's embarrassing.
Well,
you
know,
I think it was part of some economic power. Economic intervention.
WPA.
Sorry?
WPA, the Workers' Progress.
I thought that was that him? Because I thought it was FDR that brought it.
I thought it was DWP.
Oh, it was named after Cooper.
It was named after, I see. So it was part of the work program to help.
So it was just arbitrary work, like, that pay people.
Well, it's the idea that if you get people to do public works, then they are you can pay them, but they're getting money that they can then spend in the local business, and that helps to get.
This is quite common in this country as well. So here, after the problem works, when there's depression, just get people to build something.
Yeah,
they're often money from employed.
Yeah, I need to learn that. I also quite like it when you said it's quite common, and then the nearest example was after the Napoleon.
Well, that's one of the things
in mind. Well, yeah, because the problem is that the last time we had a Great Depression, we went, do you know what, let's try austerity. Let's take all the money out of the system and see how, like, oh, wait, there's now no money for anybody around.
Well, we're trying that again.
Yeah.
So who did Hoover scapegoat for the Depression?
Dyson.
I feel like everybody else, just about, right? Yeah. You know, just like communists.
I'd say that
the banks. Yeah.
Well, it went to Mexicans, so blame the foreigners.
Oh.
So he instituted policies and sponsored programs of repatriation and deportation to Mexico. By 1932, the Republican expectations for that year's election were so bleak that Hoover faced no serious opposition for renomination at the Republican National Convention. In his campaign trips around the country, Hoover was faced with hostile crowds. His train and motorcades were pelted with eggs and rotten fruit. He was often heckled while speaking, and on several occasions the Secret Service halted attempts to hurt Hoover, including one man who was approaching him with sticks of dynamite. Then
what happened? Were they
living,
or did he just give them as a gift?
Yes. Have these. Run away. Who did Hoover lose the 1932 election to?
I'd be already mentioning
Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah.
He was a good one, wasn't he? Was he the one that Ron Williams played?
Maybe, I don't know.
Night at the Museum.
Oh, no, that was Teddy Roosevelt. That was his fifth cousin.
Anyway, so Hoover only carried 6 states and lost 59-472 in the Electoral College. Roosevelt was the first Democrat in 80 years to win an outright majority in the popular and electoral votes.
No.
The previous one was Franklin Pierce in 1852. Hoover was the last incumbent president to lose re-election until Gerald Ford in 1974. Perhaps two of Hoover's most memorable quotes are, number one, about the time we think we can make ends meet, somebody moves the ends.
And number two, the only trouble with capitalism is capitalists. They're too damn greedy. So, over to you, Paul, for your mistake. Peace, thank you.
Yes, so, on this day in 1956, there was a wrestler who became a wrestler, I should say, wasn't a wrestler when he was born, Fred Ottoman. He was born in Florida, Miami, Florida. And he would start his wrestling career in 1985. He was trained by a guy called Boris Malenko. And he would work the independent scene in America until 1989, when he was hired by the then WWF, the World Wrestling Federation. And he would be given a few different characters. I don't know how many people are familiar with wrestling, but you get given a name and a character, all this kind of stuff. And he went by a couple of different names, but his main ones were as Tugboat, which was this kind of sailor-type character, which he always really quite liked. There was something a bit comic, kind of Popeye-type aspect to it. And he was a friend of Hulk Hogan, who was very big at the time, so that was a good angle there. And he then went on to portray a character called Typhoon, with him and Earthquake, natural disasters, yes. So you might know the big one, which is that in 93, he moves to another wrestling company called WCW, which is World Championship Wrestling. And there, he has one of the most infamous debuts of any wrestler ever. There's an event called Bash in the Beach, and there's a few wrestlers called Sting, the British Bulldog, and they are feuding with a couple of guys called Sid Vicious and Vader. And then Ric Flair has this program called Flair for the Gold. So they've been having this feud at Bash the Beach, and it continues on to Clash of the Champions. So there's this Flair for the Gold segment, and they decide that the next big event, Fall Brawl that year, they're going to have this big four-way match. So Sid Vicious and Vader have got Kane and Cole, who would later be known as Booker T and Stevie Ray, that's on their side. Sting and Davey Boy Smith, the British Bulldog, they've got Dustin Rose, but then they also have this mystery opponent. And he's going to make his grand debut on this programme. And Ric Flair is setting up, and there's a big competition. So eventually Sting goes, well, you're going to be shocked by our newest, our final team member, because he is the Shockmaster. And what was meant to happen was that there's this plasterboard wall, and Fred Ottoman would bash it, double axe handles, so grabbing his hands with his fist over top of his head, smash it down, the wall would collapse, there's pyro going off, and he would emerge through, and he would be this really sinister looking character. Unfortunately, what happened was two things. First of all, when they did the rehearsal, it all went fine, smashed, he went through it, did that. Somewhere between the rehearsal and the actual, workman had put a 2x4 right at his knees to reinforce the wall. So he goes to do this, and then I should point out, this is at Daytona Beach, it's in the arena, there's 5,000 watching, it's live television, it's being broadcast across the country. He gives this big smash as he did earlier, but he was a big guy. He smashes it, his knees strike the 2x4, so he goes flying forward. Now, I should also point out as well that his costume for this first appearance, for whatever reason, is a stormtrooper mask from Star Wars that's been covered in glitter, and because it has eye holes, because it's just like a mask you buy for a kid or something, they had to get one of the secretary's pantyhose, cut them to cover up the eye spots so they could put glitter on there as well. And so he can't see anything, so he gives this huge smash, he goes flying forward, flips over, it's on his back, the helmet goes flying off, he's scrambling to pick it up. It's live TV, as I mentioned, you can hear Davey Boy Smith laughing, loads of people were laughing, but he fell on his ass, he fell on his effing ass, and it's so horrible. You can see the clip on YouTube this day, and he quickly scrambles to put it back on. Eddie, what's fascinating about it is that he has this debut, and then he's seen at the pay-per-view later that year, Fall Brawl, and they've changed his gimmick now, they call it gimmicks. He's now this kind of construction worker. They still call him the Shockmaster, but he's still this kind of joke character. And at the time, Fred was humiliated. He got ribbed a lot, which in the wrestling world is having jokes played on you by other wrestlers. And in a lot of ways, it really did derail his career. So he's at WCW for about another year and a bit. Then he goes back to WWF for 94. But his career kind of peters out a little bit. He's working in the independents, but he has this huge humiliation that hangs over him for years and years and years. You get to the early 2000s, what happens is that WCW, although it did have this pay-per-view, it's not seen by many people necessarily, just because of the way things, you know, how you shared media back then. But you get to the 2000s, the rise of the internet and YouTube and this kind of stuff, it gains more notoriety, and it becomes more of this fun aspect. And as Fred himself talks about, you know, sometimes you see movies that are so-so, but then you see the blooper reels, and they're hilarious fun, and you really enjoy it. So what was, for a long time, his great failure, the thing that derailed his career, the thing that he felt, man, I've kind of lost it, becomes something that he ends up celebrating, and a lot of fans celebrate, and he goes around conventions today, and he you ever see clips of him talking about on YouTube and stuff, he's really sweet and a lovely guy, and he'll sign autographs, and people really love it. And I think there's a nice story in that, which is this: when we have these moments in our lives that feel like the greatest humiliation, our lowest points of failures, that sometimes actually they can lead to greater things, and that occasionally, if we can find the humour in some of these things, we can enjoy our lives and discover who we are in a lot of ways. So that's Fred Ottman.
I'm deeply suspicious. This is very niche.
Yeah.
Wrestling knowledge, but you said that on the plasterboard there was a piece of 2x4.
But like at the bottom.
2x4 was famously the prop always carried by Hacksaw Jim Duggan, who's another wrestler. I think he put it there.
I think you are special. And I'll bet you there's a lot of people who will watch this and listen to this podcast and go, she's onto something.
2x4? That's Hacksaw Jim Duggan's thing. He always used to carry this thing of wood. That was his thing.
Yeah.
Very specific measurement of wood. I blame you.
Another conspiracy theory. Just go on and keep going. Well, thank you so much. That was lovely. Thank you. So I think you're saying that even though we do this podcast, and years to come, we'll think back. I see, it was all right.
Yeah.
Wasn't that humiliating? Or they'll find joy in that aspect.
Right, so I don't know if the audience here were actually wanting some Edinburgh history. Is anyone from Edinburgh?
No, okay, so we can get Rose of the Brilliant.
Right, some Edinburgh history.
There are 7 hills in Edinburgh, allegedly.
This isn't particularly unusual. There are lots of places around the world that have the 7 hills. Who do you know about?
Sneezy, dark, dopey, grumpy, happy.
Did you hear the question?
I'm going to say Lisbon, because that's also hilly, like,
yeah,
a lovely place to go and visit, but you'll do some pod work going up and down. And down their tails.
Is that what comes from?
Yeah. And we... somewhere in New Zealand? Like, don't even...
I actually realised I did mishear the question. And now I realise what I've done. I'm going to say somewhere volcanic.
Like in New Zealand. I'm not sure, but it's a very long list. I don't have for the assortment. So, I just thought you might like to come.
That's
great!
That's brilliant.
New Zealand is a hilly place. I mean, most of my life, I drove a manual car, but when I lived there, I got an automatic because that is too many hill starts to be doing. It's one of those sort of volcanic places, so now fully converted.
So from that, I could then drive on the right.
Mm.
Yes.
Yes.
The way you did that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so places around the world would include Jerusalem, Athens, Tehran, Prague, Kiev, and in America, San Francisco, Washington D.C., and a place in Ohio called Seven Hills.
Not strangely taken.
What are the 7 hills which Edinburgh is supposedly built on? This is your third attempt.
Okay.
Do you want to give them? Do you know them?
Yes.
Edinburgh 7 hills? Do you want to start off and then maybe?
I don't.
No,
none of them. No, I mean,
I actually don't care. Like, I think
you actually don't care. You're on the wrong show.
No, but it's like when people start. When people start naming hills, it's a hill. Like, but anyway, go on.
Yes.
Sorry. I already said, I'm the funniest half Sri Lankan from Coventry, and that is the hill I will die on. I need to know.
That's what the friends will do to us. We'll go on the hill somewhere.
Okay, so the first appearance on the podcast, I wasn't able to name them all. The second appearance, I tried to name an alphabetical order, and I didn't manage. This time, I'm going to try an alphabetical order.
Go for the second.
Okay, so we already had Arthur's Seat.
So can I turn up the one that the castle's on? That's got to be a hill.
That's not the
left. I don't think that's its full name.
Carlton Hill and then Castle Rock.
You're already out.
Oh, no. No, wait.
Alphabetical.
Oh, okay. Can I start over?
Yes.
Okay. Hey. Arthur's Seat.
Yes.
Blackford Hills. Yes. Braids Hill. Yes. Carlton Hill.
Yes.
Castle Rock.
Yes.
Kirstor.
Yes.
Ken Hill and Craig Walker Hill.
Oh. Wow.
So Arthur's Seat is a hill just to the east of Edinburgh city centre, 822 feet above sea level, which is in fact an ancient volcanic plug.
The lava has been dated to about 340 million years old. So, Arthur Seat, how did Arthur Seat get its name?
Was it King Arthur? Want us to just have a little
this is
sit down?
One legend about is to do with King Arthur.
Not Chris.
I'm going to say it's named after the wonderful children's book that became the PBS cartoon series Arthur, which is about the aardvark.
Arthur the aardvark.
Those who grew up in the 90s, they know what I'm talking about. They know what I'm talking about.
I think the legend of King Arthur is probably more likely than...
How dare you? How dare you?
There was an 18th century merchant and historian called William Maitland who proposed some name corruption or something in Gaelic, which means height of arrows. That doesn't sound particularly exciting to be honest with that. There are some cliffs just down from Arthur's Seat called Salisbury Crags. They were formed as a glacier moved along in the last 2 million years and took away material, and that's exposed the cracks that we see today. How did the local geology inform the so-called father of modern geology, James Hutton? If you get an answer, I know that Paul would know.
Answer, so don't
panic. Work like that.
How did he inform it?
Yeah, so
TikTok.
Modern geologies come through James Hutton, largely, and he observed the geology around Salisbury Crag and some of the local places.
Did he like lick it or something? Was something really weird and go,
it's not like
glassy
rock.
No, because he was able to look at it and examine it and see that the Earth was more than 6,000 years old.
Shut up, it's not.
Oh, boy, wait till you find how old the universe is.
Yeah, so you've got sedimentary rock, you've got microvert, and you can see where one sort of formed over the other one. Didn't get observed this and realise that actually the Earth is constantly moving, and over millions of years, these things shift around. And therefore, the Earth's a lot more than 6,000 years old.
Speaking of which, you just said two interchangeable words there. What's the difference between lava and magma?
Oh, magma is underground, lava I think is above ground.
Right.
It's just like saying like Wikipedia. How do you know all of this?
I know pointless facts. I don't know important things. The key is you know a little bit about lots of different areas. So people are like, oh wow, you know a lot about politics. Or I don't. It's like, no, I know one thing about politics, one thing about economics, and you put those out and then
I disagree. I think he's the yin to my yang. I think we balance each other out. I'm just here for a lovely time in his drive.
You also sound convincing, that's the other thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I kind of go, I think.
Say it with enough conviction. Yeah.
Right, next topic and question. How is Edinburgh's monument called? The National Monument to the Fallen of the Napoleonic Wars, better known. And where is it?
Is that the Scott?
No.
Roll out your register.
No. It's not too far away from there, though.
Why, where's that?
It's on Prince Street.
Yeah.
It's the one that looks like a rocket ship.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I know that one.
There must be something to the fallen soldier somewhere. There's got to be any.
So I'm thinking of another hill that we've just mentioned in the city centre.
Is it the one on Carlton Hill?
Carlton Hill, yes. Yes.
I think I've seen that.
So it's the half-finished monument, the same design as the Parthenon in Greece. And it's known as Edinburgh's Disgrace. So what was disgraceful about it?
Is it that they didn't finish it?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, so they started and they didn't finish. Parliament offered to donate a certain amount of money, about £10,000, I believe. But £42,000 still had to be raised by public subscription. Now, they had a bit of money, so they decided to just start building anyway. But they never got to raise all the required money, so it ended up half finished, and they just stopped building in 1820.
Style.
Why have a monument in Edinburgh based on the Parthenon?
Bang.
Drop you up the Greek expert.
I'm not a Greek expert, I just Wikipedia'd some stuff. Because it's got the same climate as Greece. Don't know why you're laughing at that. Exactly the same climate. What was it, a monument to again? To fallen of the Napoleonic Wars? Is that a clue?
It's not especially,
really.
Not especially, but it was from the 1820s, so maybe that's a clue.
The old 1820s.
So Edinburgh was known as the Athens of the North.
Why?
Okay, I get that. 18th century, so there's a lot of philosophers.
But very different. Like, we were UK philosophy is fucking dull. Oh, it's so dull. But yeah, I suppose the Enlightenment came around then, and so that would have been an outlier to death.
So one of the leading men behind the campaign to have this model of the cardinal was someone called Thomas Bruce, 7th Earl of Elgin.
Didn't write anything about him. Clinton.
Elgin Marbles. He was the one that stole
the same thing. Nice. Yeah.
Thief.
Thief!
Stop that man.
I've done it, been given back now.
I think there's negotiations.
Have we lost our marbles?
Well, no one plays marbles anymore, so it's like kind of arbitrary.
Indeed.
I literally me crowbarring in, have we lost our marbles?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Don't worry, it deserves
to be talked about, it's fine.
Just roll with it.
There we go.
Hey, it's all the puns today.
Well, if you said you did puns, I thought that was for you.
So, thank you. I almost appreciated it.
That is my final.
So you've got this half-completed monument, and over the years, people have thought, actually, maybe we could complete it and make it into something. So what sort of things have people thought about over the years?
Knowing Scotland, probably to turn it into a bar, I guess. It's like a little whiskey speakeasy.
Yeah, I think student accommodations is the main one at the
popular
moment.
Popular
yeah. I don't know, like a bubble tea shop? That seems to be quite popular at the moment.
Might as well. Well, when Queen Victoria died in 1901, people thought, well, we could make a monument to her. That didn't happen. There were also proposals to commemorate the 200th anniversary of the 1707 Act of Union with England. For some reason, that wasn't very popular. a new Scottish National Gallery in 1907. Scottish Parliament building in 1908, so ahead of its time.
Which would have been, why is Holyrood down the bottom of the hill?
Well, it's
near the palace. Because that would have made more sense for it to be more central.
Yeah, but I think these parliamentarians to be thought, well, it'd be nice if we had our own building and we could make
it.
You get a group because the Scottish Assembly was in that building that's beside Carlton Hill. So when I think that was
always proposed to be.
Oh, it was supposed to be, sorry.
It was always proposed to be, wasn't it?
Yeah.
When the opportunity actually came along to have a parliament, they thought, oh no, we want our own building, we want it like this, we want our own little rooms.
I know where the parliament
three
is
times
now.
About the only we were going to. So.
Sorry, I know where the parliament is now, because it's right by my venue. It's right by the Brewdog. You should check it out at 5:30, guys.
But is parliament in recess at the moment? Because they get lots of holidays.
Yeah,
I think it's in
recess.
Parliament's in recess most months.
They're all working from that.
Yeah. So, again, half-finished buildings still not completed. So how did Glasgow Council offer to help?
Destroy Edinburgh.
Just destroy Edinburgh. Don't worry, nobody will notice your half-finished building.
It was like, we're going to take over the Scottish Parliament. They were going to nuke Edinburgh.
Did they offer to take it away?
Don't worry, I'll get that column, you get that one, here we go, right. Doss the gamer, doss this!
Given that the foundation stone itself weighed about 6 tonnes, it would have taken a lot of effort, but I like the idea.
I would not put it past the determination of the good people of Glasgow to just nick it.
Apologies to anyone in the audience who might be from Glasgow. So at one stage, Glasgow Council offered to complete the monument as long as its own coat of arms could be visible on the monument. And Edinburgh politely declined, and hence one of the other names for the monument, which is the pride and the property. But, and I think a member of the audience might remember this, where was a full-scale replica of the Parthenon actually successfully built and completed in 1907?
Oh, I want to say Las Vegas.
Oh, that sounds so good, doesn't it? It's not the answer. I've got those. Make it.
I don't know. I think this gentleman.
Right. So he can have him tell us in Nashville, Tennessee. Nashville, Tennessee.
No.
So you celebrate the 100th anniversary of the state of Tennessee.
You're welcome to be on the next panel if you want. Right. Very long question, so please concentrate. What happened in 1960 which made the Keeper of the Great Seal of Scotland move the regalia of Scotland from the Crown Room in Edinburgh Castle to one of its castle walls?
Could you just repeat that quick?
Oh, well, I don't really hate it. So it was in 1916.
Yeah.
And some guys in the castle.
Yeah.
They moved the Crown Room's regalia of Scotland down to some vaults for safekeeping.
Oh, it had been the First World War.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that was an anti-climb, right?
It was the Great Seal bit that got me. I was like, what was the seal doing?
It's bad. It
should be at the zoo.
Yeah.
Was there... this is 1914, so they still have, like, planes and stuff there. I
hold it a bit high. It was something aerial, yes, in 1916.
Do the works.
No, that's the wrong one. This is the Great Swarm. We talk about it.
Again, very large and immense, not as
anything. Yeah. So there were German air raids on the city. One bomb exploded near the castle, so they thought we'd better put these jewels and stuff away for safekeeping. But what was novel in 1916 about these particular air raids?
Well, first of all, just that there were air raids.
Yes.
Like think about, like, up to that point, a battle was something that happened far off in either a different country or somewhere out there, and suddenly this thing comes over, whatever it might be, and it's just dropping bombs. And so it's like, oh, now we're involved in any conflicts going forward now for the rest of human history.
But there's also, like, stories, and it's quite chronicled that, like, the sort of early aircraft, the Germans and the British and the Allies and the enemies would like wave at each other because they saw themselves like, hiya! And then I think it started as, like, people started throwing bricks at each other, like, ooh, you naughty, and then started taking guns on there and stuff. And it actually took quite a while for that to escalate, because at first there were, like, two bus drivers on Princes Street, like, hi!
Imagine if probably early they used it as just reconnaissance. And then suddenly she's like, do you know what? If I bring my pistol with me,
yeah.
Oh!
It's like a lot of the early planes were made of wood and like paper. It's mad.
They just threw a lighter.
Glad you're up there. So, yeah, what you said about bombs and the war coming is, I guess, what Ukraine's trying to do to Moscow is sort of saying, to people in Moscow, actually, you are involved. You can't just stay on the ledge. But also, what's happening in the war in Ukraine at the moment is with drones. It's mirroring the same issue as aeroplanes.
But
so there's reconnaissance going on. And then there's drones on either side, they think, oh, well, we need to knock out the drone, and now we're trying to sort of find ways of taking the drones out and stuff.
Ironically, there's kind of, it can kind of galvanise the spirit, because, like, they did studies on this, and, like, the kind of blitz spirit, people found that if you survived an air raid, it didn't kill your morale, you kind of almost felt invincible.
That happened, so I'm from Coventry, which was heavily bombed, and they said, because they targeted Coventry because that's where a lot of the engines were built, so, like, Jaguar, Rolls-Royce and so on, two of them, engines were made there. And they said that after the Germans had flown over and pretty much flattened it, the following day the workers put their hard hats back on and went back to work and increased their output. It sort of made them say, right, and they worked even quicker. So it didn't quite work in their favour, it just sort of made them work
and
hard.
All these years, and all these years later, that's basically what the Edinburgh Fringe does. It just wakes you financially, morally, and psychologically in order to go out there and be stronger.
And you just hope the UN show doesn't bother.
Oh, it does. Every day. Zeppelins.
Zeppelins.
Was that the answer to the question you were asking?
Yes, I guess it's forgotten the question. We've gone way off topic today. So, yes, they were carried out by Zeppelins. That was what was in each. So it was only for about half an hour, but on the night of the 2nd to 3rd of April 1916, two German airships, the L-14 and L-22, dropped 7 incendiary and 17 high-explosive bombs on Leith and the city of Edinburgh. 13 people died and 24 were injured. The White Hart Hotel in the Grassmarket and the County Hotel in Lothian Road suffered substantial damage, as well as a number of tenement buildings in Alewington. There's a flagstone in the Grassmarket, which you can see, and that marks the spot where a bomb landed in front of the White Hart Inn, making a 9 by 6 foot crater. Talking of the White Hart Inn, parts of that building date back to 1516, and that makes it the oldest pub in Edinburgh city centre, and the pub also claims to be the most haunted.
But
But
how do you measure these things?
Some people say that every pub's the most haunted because...
And then the adults say, oh, ghosts don't exist.
Yeah, no one ever says we're the second most haunted.
Ghosts for that top shelf.
Most haunted.
They had a ghost last week. So, that's so unfair. We were the most haunted. Who stayed at the inn during his last visit to Edinburgh in 1791 and their bid farewell to his lover, Agnes Nancy McAlose, before she left to Jamaica? I'm thinking of a poet.
Yes.
Oh, Robbie Burns!
Yay!
Robbie Burns. Do you know, I've got a fact about Robbie Burns. The Counting House is the reason that Robbie Burns existed. There's a beautiful story. I know that the landlord, he said that Robbie Burns had got one of the first ships over to New Land, to America, I think it was. And he was going to go, and he bought his ticket. But then I can't remember his name, who owned the Counting House, literally the morning he was going to go, I said, well, what, like, if things are tough, why don't you just come and stay, like, with me? And he did. And if he hadn't have done that, the ship that he was going over to America on sank, and everybody died. So had he not have stayed at the Counting House, Robbie Burns, that was before he was famous, and had he not had stayed at the Counting House, he'd be dead.
Wow. Which makes you wonder who else was on the ship who might have been...
Big time.
We'll never know. Interesting, thank you for that. So in 1803, William and Dorothy Wordsworth stayed at the White Hart while on their tour of Scotland. Now, given that this pub was in the Grassmarket, or this team, how do you think Dorothy described the pub in an early version of TripAdvisor?
I'm going to say if it's at Grassmarket, which is near Cowgate, it would be filthy. And smelly. The drains need a bit of work.
And that seems entirely reasonable, is it? Because I guess...
I reckon it would have been something like proper, that wordier than that, though. Essentially said, this place is the shit out one star.
Well, she said it was not noisy and it was tolerably cheap.
Wow.
So how times
definitely wasn't during the Fringe.
Definitely is. So this was a lot of times.
Because there's a pub there that used to, I think it's called The Last Drop, and that's because that was the last place they'd go before they were executed. Did they still do executions then? 1803.
Well, I mean,
presumably.
Maybe, I actually don't know. I mean, execution was still legal in Britain until, like, and of course,
I think public executions were going out of fashion.
Imagine going to a public execution, they're like, it costs a lot to part in these executions, so it's free to watch, it's not free to leave.
We've got a bucket for your head.
Yeah.
Right, this is a special for you, Dave, because I know this week it's close to your mouth. So, who was Greyfriars Bobby?
But he was a beautiful little dog, and you can still touch his nose. And he wore a little mask when there was COVID. He was very obscure. He was a little dog who his owner died. I'm actually kind of scanning the details, but my understanding is that Greyfriars Bobby was just a guy's dog, and then the guy died, and then the dog stayed on his grave
for 14 years. And what kind of dog was he?
Boomerful.
Yeah.
It's
a little one, isn't it?
A little one.
Yeah, because I've seen the statue.
Oh, it'll be a Scotty dog, won't it?
Sorry, it's not actually a Skye Terrier dog. You have to be very careful about instincts, because I'll explain in a minute. So, Bobby's headstone was placed by the Dog Aid Society at the Kirkyard, Greyfriars Kirkyard's entrance in 1981. What spot does this mark?
Was the spot where he would held a massive political rally on behalf of the Conservative Party.
In 1981?
Yeah.
Seriously?
So it doesn't mark any particular spot. A lot of tourists think, oh, that must be where it was staying on the Moss's Way, but actually, that's just a misconception. In 19th century Europe, there are over 60 documented accounts of graveyard or cemetery stray dogs who were fed by visitors and curators, to the point that the dogs made the graveyards their home.
And then people made the connection and think, oh, well, they're just staying on the grain or someone.
Yeah, they're just there for food.
But actually, what happened in Edinburgh was, they thought, oh, it's happening here. This is a way we can somehow make some money out of this. Brings on like Edinburgh at all. And one author reckons that the original Bobby actually died in 1867, so they just replaced him with another dog. Because they just wanted to keep the money making scheme.
Honestly, it's like Blue Peter.
Was that a tortoise or a dog?
They obviously had a riff, was it?
Yeah, they had a tortoise.
Neighbours, Bouncer, went through like 12 different dogs.
And that would also explain how the dog managed to live for so long as well, but it was like there was more than one dog. Now, the ninth.
That's all we said, 14
years. Yes, exactly. Yes,
where's the dog? The dog, she is. Yeah,
just given a good point.
There's a bit more.
So the 1912 novel, Grace Wright's Bobby, by the American author Eleanor Atkinson, popularised the story in the United States, and her version of the story is the one which is most familiar to people today. Why is this surprising? Or maybe not surprising.
Because she was American? And it's like a Scottish story.
Beans.
And... You can't tell me what I find surprising. I find that surprising, so I'm answering the question.
Yeah, right. What I find surprising, or not surprising, is the fact that she never set foot in Scotland.
No!
And she just made up a lot of the stories.
Lying bitch.
Yeah, is that awful?
Awful. And you're going to tell me how
to do that? Using a doctor, not swearing.
Yeah.
How did the English philanthropist Lady Burdett Coutts choose to commemorate Bobby after he died?
But that's actually,
yeah, but that's actually,
yeah.
The one with the shininess, yeah. So the idea is it's meant to be a drinking fountain, so that, like, humans could drink from the top part and dogs could drink from the bottom part. But in about 1975, Edinburgh Council shut down all the drinking fountains due to a health scare.
Yes, so you'll not have your drinking water in Scotland, right? Just whiskey.
Gotcha.
And tenants.
What is unusual about this particular monument in Edinburgh, or most unusual?
It's free to see.
Yes. It's actually a fringe venue, apparently.
No.
That's not the answer.
Oh, right. What's unusual about this?
Do you know its size?
It's not the size that matters, Richard.
It is for this answer. That's it does matter for this answer.
Is it unusual because they finished it?
Yes. Yeah, amazing. Something small they managed to finish.
Yeah.
It's small.
Yeah, green book. You know,
it's the smallest historical monument.
Yeah. It's the smallest one.
In what, in Scotland?
I think in the Eastern UK or just Scotland.
Certainly in Edinburgh.
In Edinburgh.
I think they learned that lesson from the first one. They've, like, we've gone too late. Like, these foundations are massive and we've run out of budget.
We're running out of time.